Hi, this is Emily Detweiler, CEO of KCBS, and you are listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts.
From the studios of Baseball and Barbecue on Long Island, New York, this is episode number 146. I'm Jeff Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman. Welcome back to our podcast. Leonard, what's going on?
Hi, Jeff, it's great to see you, to hear you. I could not wait to get back because you had to split, and I'm saying you. You're taking all the blame.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You had to split Janice.
Yeah, I know.
Smella of Smella BBQ, Smella Barbecue, into two parts with Doug Scheiding.
Well, that's what happens when you talk too much.
Yeah, I have a habit of doing that. I get it, but I'm like, what's going to happen?
Well, we get to enjoy her twice.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to it because you left us on a cliffhanger, Jeff.
Believe me, that was no cliffhanger.
But yeah, we are looking forward to it. This is like deja vu all over again. We've got two great guests.
Yes.
Tell us, who are they, Jeff?
We have Pat, and I hope I'm pronouncing this name right, Gagan, from the organization Save the Game. They are an organization, a grassroots organization, that wants to put action back into baseball. And they think that, you know, baseball has become the three outcomes, strikeout, walk, home run. And they're trying to get action back into the game. And they're doing a grassroots effort.
And we're going to get back to that in 1 second. But let me just tell everyone about Bet Online. Bet Online is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports, contests, and events with first-to-market odds and lines. Find reviews and news for every league, including Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, combat sports, esports, and even golf. Bet Online continues to be the top online resource for all your sports information, from live in-game betting, props, and futures. Head to BetOnline today or use your mobile device to join and make your first sports bet. Use our promo code BLEAV50. That's BLEAV50 to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts. And Jeff, you were saying about Save the Game, a great organization with a great purpose. After people hear this, hopefully they'll hear about the petition that needs to be signed. They'll hear about how I nominated you to be on the board. Okay, there's a lot going on in this interview with Pat Kagan. Let's get right to it.
Save the Game was launched in January by a pair of former local college baseball standouts, Kevin Gallagher of Pace University and Pat Gagan of Mercy College. The pair is joined by ex-major leaguer Jeff Fry, who hoped to collect 1 million signatures on a petition urging livelier pace on the diamond. On the advisory board is former U.S. Congressman Peter King. The reason we asked Pat to join us on Baseball and Barbecue is we all love the game of baseball. We've all seen the changes in this game, and, well, the changes over the past decade and a half is not good. They have a campaign called Save the Game. Check it out. The website, SaveTheGameUS.com. Welcome, Pat.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome. So, Jeff, Pat, Jeff, did you sign the petition?
I did sign the petition.
Okay.
I'm right, on the way to a million.
There you go. Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
So Pat, tell us, Save the Game, what's it all about? I mean, I came across this, I read an article on Gotham Baseball by our friend Mark Healy, and mm-hmm. I noticed that Peter King was involved, and I happen to run into Peter King every once in a while at my local 7-Eleven.
I saw that the other day, yeah.
Yeah, and I check out this website, and I'm going, wow, I agree with all this. So tell us, what's all about?
So Save the Game started back in 2021. The genesis of Save the Game was Kevin's book, my partner Kevin Gallagher's book, Teacher Kid to Hit So They Don't Quit. So this was a book that Kevin had in his DNA for many years, and he finally decided to write it back in the 2019. I believe he published it in 2020. My college coach, Rick Wolf, wrote the foreword to the book. He wrote that book to teach the average parent on how to teach their kid to hit a baseball, because, you know, it's one of the more frustrating things for a kid is to learn how to hit a baseball or a softball if you're a young lady. So he wanted to have an 8-step process to have a parent go out and teach their kid how to hit a baseball. It became somewhat of a sensation with, you know, people beyond parents and coaches. It wound up in the hands of the Boston Red Sox. It wound up in the hands of ex-GMs, ex-players, scouts, special assistants to the GM. And when they read the book, and what Kevin talked about in the book was what's hurting the game of baseball is the launch angle swing. And he wanted to get back to contact hitting, which is this top hand hitting approach. You know, they said, you know, a lot of the things that he talked about in the book is to what's happening with the game at the major league level and throughout the baseball ecosystem is that this resonated very, very well. We got a lot of feedback. We decided to start this movement based upon the feedback we got. We've been featured in articles by Bob Nightingale and Kevin Kernan from USA and Ball 9, respectively. So, you know, we're very pleased with the amount of coverage that we're getting, but more importantly, the amount of interest that we're getting, because the feedback that we get is keep doing what you're doing, guys, because, you know, we need to save the game. And, you know, we want to reverse some of the trends that are going on with youth participation as well, too. But we'll get into that in a little bit. But that's really where Save the Game came from.
It's a serious topic. I want to really get into it. But before we do, I've got to ask Jeff, Peter King, what flavor Slurpee does he get? Is he like, does he mix the flavors? I like to mix them. I don't know if Peter King's a mixer or just one flavor.
He's more of a coffee guy and a newspaper. I don't think he does big on Slurpees. So.
He doesn't like to get brain freeze.
No.
All right. So, okay. Pat, fascinating to read about, to read about this whole thing. At first, when I saw Save the Game, I thought it was going to be all about all the rule changes and things that are going on. And that's part of it. But it's the whole getting the youth or as they say, my cousin Vinny, the youths involved in baseball. And I heard some interviews with Billy Blitzer, who's on your advisory board. I heard him and I heard
Jeff Fryer.
On an interview, and they mentioned they saw 10 kids outside of a store and not one of them played baseball. So that is an issue that we need to address, is how do we get the kids to play the game again? And it's something that's come up. Jeff's brought it up to some people on some of our shows, because I was fascinated to find that the average age of a baseball fan is 57.
That's right. Yeah, I'm just a little bit north of that average. And yeah, I mean, what Kevin and I started to talk about when we had Jeff join us back in the late 2021 timeframe was that, you know, when we move on, our generation moves on, who is going to replace us in terms of, you know, fans? So we look at youth participation. If you take a look at the youth participation statistics, they've dropped 26% from 2008 until 2020. And if things keep going, that percentage is only going to increase. And we just see that we are not attracting the young fan, or the game is not attracting the young fan like they should. They have many more things to go choose from. They can go watch UFC. They can go watch the NBA or the NFL or lacrosse or soccer, all great sports. But we're not having, the kids are not excited about the game. They think the game is boring. And that's, again, to go back to Kevin's book, he was trying to take the mystery out of hitting a baseball to make it more exciting for, you know, a parent to teach a kid. So we realized, you know, in talking with some of the people in professional baseball that are, you know, have been in the game for a long time, you know, they said to us, you know, in order to save the game, you have to grow the game, right? So growing the game with the youth is paramount. I mean, Peter King, we talked about this with Peter King, and he's on our board, as you know, and Fred Cambria, and we got to Peter via Fred. And Fred, I've known for about 15 years. He played in the Pirates organization, but they both remember when growing up in Queens that you could go out and find a baseball game any time of day. You could go to the schoolyard, you could go to the ball field and you could choose up sides and people would hit between first and second and you supplied the pitcher and you supplied the catcher while you were at bat, right? So all these types of things. So
Excuse me, Pat, that's exactly what I did when I was living in Queens. When I was a kid, we went to the park and we had a pickup game.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I grew up in the Bronx and we would go over to, you know, Van Cortlandt Park across the street. I grew up by Manhattan College and that's exactly what we did. You know, we had 242nd Street, would play the kids from 238th Street, or the seventh grade kids in Visitation where I went to Catholic school would play the eighth grade kids. And that's what we would do. And we would self-umpire, we would self-officiate, we would self-regulate the entire game. But we grew up, we grew up loving the game of baseball, right? So even some of the players that kids that I played with didn't become, you know, baseball fans through Little League and through high school and college like I did and Kevin did, but they became baseball fans for life. And that's what we're missing. We're not capturing that baseball fan for life at a young age, because that's when they get the fever, right? You know, you may not be, you all think about you can play in Yankee Stadium or Citi Field or wherever your favorite team plays, but you know, the reality of it is most of us are not going to get there, but we still love the game, right? And that's why we go and fill up the stands when we can, right?
Absolutely. You know, on your website, you list out the five issues, I guess the importance of what's changed the game. I'll just list them out here. MLB has changed the fundamentals of the game. Will MLB be relevant in 15 years? Like you're talking about bringing in the youth of the game. The youth of America is not interested in baseball. MLB competition is action, but Major League Baseball knows it's having a problem, but you know they're really not doing much to solve it.
I think they're doing things that are, I don't want to say superficial. Superficial is the wrong word, but they're doing things that are, they're going to, Kevin talks about this all the time. They're trying to take a 3.5 hour boring game and boil it down to a 3 hour boring game. You know, putting a runner on second base in the 10th inning, that is like, that doesn't make sense to me. They want to widen the bases. They want to potentially move the pitcher's mound back. They want to initiate the pitch clock, which if you watch the Yankee Red Sox game the other night, when the pitcher came in after Chris Sale broke his pinky, he's taken 35 seconds between pitches. When I got the ball as a pitcher, you know, my father taught me, when you get the ball back, you get ready and you get up there and you fire away. You get the pitch and you go. What we think has to change is, you know, for Major League Baseball, it's not the 3.5 hour game that's exciting. It's that 3.5 hour game like the Yankees and Red Sox played the other day, where the pace of the game is just egregiously slow. I mean, I couldn't watch it at times, right? And even Don Mattingly has said, you know, sometimes, you know, baseball is unwatchable at times because nothing's happening. So we really need to bring that back in. And that's what we talk about with Save the Game, is that we really want to bring back the pace of the game as opposed to the length of the game, right? Make more action in the game. And if you have action, you know, for kids to watch it and kids playing it, they're definitely going to become fans. So that's how we see it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because there was a time all you heard about was, because kids would play soccer. And for years you heard, oh, soccer is going to become this huge sport because the kids are playing it. I don't know that soccer's ever become, in this country at least, soccer's not, I'm not seeing soccer on the back pages of the newspaper. Obviously, kids playing a sport helps them to watch a sport, but soccer is an example of kids playing a sport that really don't watch the sport. As far as the, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here a little bit. I think what's happening is if a team played a different type of game and it wasn't all about the homers, you know, it was about speed and it was about hit and runs and all that, and they won, and they won it all of a sudden, maybe the other teams would, you know, it's a copycat effect. Maybe other teams would do that. It's hard to see a team. I mean, the Mets this year are a little more like that. They're winning. They're not hitting as many home runs. And they're playing exciting baseball. I'm trying to think of things that will get the kids watching again. Is it they just have other interests? Is that, I mean, they have.
So you're really fighting for their eyeballs, right?
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah,
from
that's
a,
it.
From an entertainment perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So they can, you know, look, we know that a lot of the youth today, they live online. They live on their phone or they live on their laptop and they're playing games with friends that live, no, not necessarily in the same town. They have people that they play Doom or Grand Theft Auto or whatever the games that they play, and they could be playing from somebody from California, right? You know, Kevin said he was talking with his grandson one day and they were playing some game. He says, oh, where does your friend live? And Kevin's, I think grandson lives up in Pennsylvania. He said, well, he's in Texas. So it kind of dawned on us that, like, okay, these kids are not living in that schoolyard pickup game environment that we grew up in. They're living online. So in order for us to attract them, we have to go to where they are. So we have to go to their devices. We have to go online. You know, Kevin had a conversation with Patrick Wilson, who I believe is the COO of Little League. He said, Kevin, love your book, but if you come to me with an app, we definitely want to talk to you. Right. So Kevin and I have talked about that. We have designs on taking his book and creating an app. We also want to create an online teaching vehicle that will actually teach a kid. They can use any smartphone that if you put in the model swing plane to model against, and then the youth goes up and practices their swing against that, it will give you instantaneous feedback and say, okay, this is what you need to do. But take that one step further. We could incorporate that into a game. If you watch the show and I saw this down in Charleston, I was visiting my daughter and her boyfriend over the 4th of July weekend. And he brought this video game up the show and it was Shohei Ohtani. And they were playing, it was the Boston Red Sox and the Atlanta Braves in Fenway Park. And actually Atlanta was the home team and the Red Sox was the visiting team, but you got to see the pitches. You could take the pitches. You could see what was happening. But if we could inject a child into a game and have them swing against Chris Sale, have them swing against Gerrit Cole, and you can play them in any ballpark you want to play, and you have your swing and the model swing, it just gets them to be more excited about the game of baseball, right? So not only do we want it to be a teaching vehicle, but we want them to have fun doing it at the same time. And I think that's why kids are attracted to other things, right? If you're playing in a game of soccer, everybody's moving around. In baseball, it's, you know, there's a lot of waiting around at times. So standing, that's why around, we want to bring, right, it back to action.
Yeah. But Pat, is it possible, and I hope this isn't the case, but I'm trying to ask the questions that, you know, people want to know. Is it possible, like with boxing? You know, boxing was, you know, when there was a major fight, everyone watched. You know, everyone knew who Mike Tyson was.
Yeah.
No, and it didn't have to be heavyweights. Everybody knew who, you know, Leon Spinks was, and Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran and Hearns and all that, right? Everybody knew these players, these boxers. Boxing is not what it was.
No.
Is it possible that baseball, it's not going to drop off the face of the earth, but it may well be that it's not going to have the same It's not going to have the same place that it does. It will still be an important part. There will still be a lot of fans, but it's possible that it may be, you know, football, basketball.
This is what they're trying to do, to change that.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is it's possible that no matter what is done, could maybe not work. You know what I mean? I understand how. Jeff, you have a son who loves baseball, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I got two sons. One loves baseball.
Well, I'm saying a son.
He's 21 now, but he loved it from when he was a kid. Now, right. let me ask you, Pat, with the advent of these analytics, did that really change the way baseball is played and viewed? I mean, tell us, is that one of the causes that why we have a problem?
Certainly, I think that analytics, to the extent that everybody just looks at the statistics and they don't look at the actual pace of the game and they don't look at the character that makes up a ball player, et cetera. I think that analytics have gone too far. You know, I think that what has happened is that, you know, they rely so much on these statistics that they have gotten away from to how to really manage a game. If you go back to what Leonard was talking about earlier in the conversation about the Mets started out the year as a really exciting team to watch. I mean, they were doing all the small things. They were hitting behind the runner. They were stealing bases. They were, you know, going from first to third on the throw. I mean, they were doing all the things. Yeah. Did they have the occasional home run? Absolutely. But were they playing a much more exciting brand of baseball? Absolutely. And, you know, I think Buck Showalter likes statistics, but he's also a really good baseball man. And he has them playing smart baseball, and he has the pace of the game has really picked up. But I think the over-reliance on analytics has hurt the game. And we need to get back to how do we get the action back in the game? Because you have pitchers that come in the game today. They all are pitching like they were Sandy Koufax. Everybody is averaging 12 strikeouts a game, depending on whether you're a starter or reliever, because the hitters are only so good. They're not, there's too many players that are using the launch angle swing. Mm-hmm. We're not saying that you don't need the launch angle swing, but what we're saying is not everybody else, the rest of the 90% of the ball players are not going to be launch angle swing guys. Let's bring back the contact into the game and bring back what makes the game exciting again. And that's contact hitting, right? It's just fundamental to making this game, you know, viable.
Right. And speaking of contact hitting, but when they do hit on contact, they're hitting into the shift. Now, one of the rules changes that they're contemplating is banning the shift. Now, I love baseball my whole life. I would not want to see that. I'd rather see the batter learn how to hit where they ain't. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah. And I know it's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, I play softball. I keep hitting to the left side, whatever, but yeah. You know, these are professionals. They should be able to hit to all fields.
They should. I mean, to me, they had a shift for Ted Williams years ago, right?
Sure. Yep.
He still was, what did he hit? I forget what his career batting average was. It was in the high 300s.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
I can't remember, but it was something astronomical. But, you know, if you think about that, like you said, Jeff, if there's a player up and you have four outfielders and all the infielders are on the right side of the infield, why can't you try and butcher ball the boy to short? Why can't you do that? I mean, to me, that would make sense. I mean, then you don't have to think about the, you know, banning the shift. I mean, to me, that doesn't seem logical. Look, if teams want to play the shift, great. But then these players, particularly at that level of advanced hitting, they shouldn't know how to hit the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to me, that would make sense. And I think that's what Kevin and I and Jeff have been talking about for quite some time is let's bring that back to the game because, you know, that the art of that part of hitting at the major league level has been lost for quite some time. So that's why the shift came into being, in my opinion.
We just had the home run derby. and I was listening to the MLB network, and I heard them say that if Pujols won the Derby, it would be great for baseball. And I didn't agree with that. I think it's great for baseball that Soto won. He's a young guy. He's exciting. And I think that one of the things that baseball needs to do, and I've heard this before, this isn't an original thought, they need to promote their young players, their exciting young players, like sure. a Soto. Baseball doesn't, I don't know what else they can do to promote, but you've got Shohei Ohtani. He's so exciting. I love watching him play. You know, I mean, an amazing player. And again, Soto, DeGrom when he's healthy. Maybe it's they need to do more to promote their players. It's interesting because it's not like in football where they're wearing helmets. I mean, you can see the players, you can identify them. Is that something that they can do? And maybe that will get more people.
I think that's part of what they need to do. There's a statistic out there. If you look at all of the top sports personalities that are identified by the youth, the top 25, there's not one baseball player in the top 25, right? So that's LeBron terrible. James is identifiable. Stephon Curry is identifiable. Odell Beckham is identifiable. You know, you have a lot of players that are identifiable, but no one in baseball is identifiable. So there's an identity crisis to a certain extent that, you know, these young kids, like when we were little, don't have anybody to look up to. They don't have anybody to identify with. So could Major League Baseball be doing a better job of promoting their young talent? Absolutely. And making, by having the games be more exciting and more watchable and the pace of the game improve, to watch a Juan Soto play, to watch a Gleyber Torres play, to watch Jacob DeGrom. Yeah, we definitely want them to start to identify with these players. So just like we did when we were kids, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I grew up watching Thurman Munson and, you know, Catfish Hunter and Frank Robinson and, you know, all of these guys, Juan Marichal. I mean, you watch these guys and you wanted to be like them. So
kids today are who do watch baseball, they're getting thrown terms that we've never heard of. I mean, we hear them now, but we never heard them when we were growing up. But the exit velocity, the OPS, on base plus slugging, it's all these other terms that they're using. I mean, there's one that really bothers me, the catch probability. I mean, you know, when they show that on the screen, I go, there's two possibilities. If he catches it or he doesn't catch it. That's the catch probability. Now they have all these stats and he went this far to catch. I mean, do we really care? I mean, do the kids really care? They want to see that the action is actually made instead of, you know, how far he went. I mean, no one's been talking about that.
Well, that's the kind of the over-rotation on analytics, right? I mean, what you just described there, Jeff, is kind of that over-rotation where they've now tried to create an analytic for everything. And I get it. And I understand it. But does that make it more exciting for a kid to watch the game? To me, like, here's the Nirvana state that I tend to think about. You're watching the game, the ESPN Saturday night game of the week. Or no, it's a Sunday night game of the week, right? Fox has the Saturday night game of the week. But whoever, you have Joe Buck and you got John Smoltz, right, doing the game on Fox. And let's say Ozuna comes up and he hits a ball to right field and it's a double in the gap, right? Wouldn't it be great to say, you know, you could say, you have John Smoltz break down his swing. Kids, this is what he did well on that. Let me show you how he came through the hitting zone and he followed the 8-step process on how to make contact with a baseball. And then you have Dansby Swanson come up and he pops one up. Well, here's what he did. Here's the model swing plane. And here's what he did. He dropped his elbow. He didn't use his top hand. So use the broadcast as a teaching vehicle. That's what they used to do years ago. They used to talk about that. This is what was happening in the game. I don't know if they necessarily do that now. They talk more about the analytics and they're talking to an analytic crowd, but I think quite honestly, they're all capable of doing that. If we gave them the tools to do that, those guys could absolutely be that teaching vehicle. And if you think about it, if John Smoltz is saying this is how Ozuna just did, and Ozuna is a young guy, don't you think that Jeff Cohen, the 10-year-old kid, is going to be watching Marcell Ozuna and John Smoltz just told him what he did on how to hit a baseball? You don't think Jeff Cohen's going to go out there and try and do that tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Of course he is, right? Yeah. So, and that's the attraction that we need to bring back, is we need to have the broadcast be a teaching vehicle as well, right? It's just not about analytics.
And you just made a great point, which I was going to bring up later, but since you mentioned the broadcast, you mentioned Fox and ESPN. The other day I was looking, the Met game was on. I was looking for it. It wasn't on SNY. I checked MLB. I went to ESPN. I went to Fox Sports 1, Fox Sports, TNT, TBS. I couldn't find the game. It was on local station WPIX. Eventually, I found it. But
you used to watch all the games on PIX.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I know. And, you know, yeah. if trying to find a game these days is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, and now you have other, you know, now you have, you know, streaming. You have right. Apple TV is showing, you know, games on Friday nights, two games a night. And you have
the Yankees, you know, Prime are on Prime. Yeah.
Games too. So I understand why they're doing that, but you need to be able to make it accessible for people, right? I get why they're doing it, but you need, to your point, it needs to be easier to find where the game is being broadcast, right?
They're also with the kids. The tickets. I remember as a kid, you could earn tickets. Either you could save milk yeah. carton labels, or you can get good grades in school, or you could, and there were ways to earn tickets. Also, as a kid, there was the show, the Baseball Bunch, or what was that show, Jeff, with the San Diego Chicken that was on with Johnny Bench and all that.
I think it was Baseball Bunch.
Yeah. Those were things. I will say, though, the one thing I think that is good for the future of baseball, and this is where people that are the more teams in the playoffs is better for the game, because at least a fan of a team, whether it's in a Pittsburgh or a different city, maybe has a chance of making the playoffs with an expanded playoff format. But they need to play more games during times when kids can actually be awake to see a whole game, not to have to go to sleep after the third inning. They need to make games earlier is another thing. If kids can't watch the games with their father or their mother or whoever that is watching it, they're not going to want to see the game or play.
I don't know how old you guys are, but I remember running home from school in October to watch the World Series as a day game.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I ran home to watch the World Series. I remember it was, I think it was the 70. I remember the 69 World Series with the Mets and the Orioles. And I remember running home to watch the World Series that year. And then, you know, every year after that, that's exactly what I would do. And then they started making them night games, I think, in the mid to late 70s. They became much more of a nighttime because they wanted prime time. But, you know, I remember I was a kid. I could not stay up past 8 o'clock because I had to get up and go to school the next day. You know, so like Monday Night Football, I wasn't allowed to stay up to watch Monday Night Football because it started at 9 o'clock. You know, I remember when I was, you know, a teenager and in my early 20s going to the games at Yankee Stadium, the game night game started at 8 o'clock. That was late.
Yeah. Huh?
Now they start at 7.
Mm-hmm.
6:35 is a really good time. They do some of those. Yeah. But I think we need to make it more accessible to your point, Leonard. We need to make it more accessible to the youth. As far as tickets are concerned, Kevin had a great idea. I mean, you talk about, I remember you used to be able to cut out the Dairy League coupons on the
bill. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about.
You got 10 of those and you can get a ticket or your ticket cost a dollar, whatever it was.
Right.
You know, Kevin says, hey, why don't we start to let kids in for free? You know, have a parent bring in, you know, kids under 12 during the week, you know, have a parent pay for their ticket. The kids get in for free, you know, let them buy a hot dog and a soda. What a wonderful thing to do and get them into a day game, right? Remember, you used to be able to go on the field after the game. I remember, Yankee Stadium, you used to be able to walk out on the field when you exited the game. The Shea Stadium used to do the same thing years ago, right? So
I just got an idea. We're talking about, you know, the parent can bring the kid for free. They could walk out on the field. What if there's an incentive to bring your child? You bring your child to the game and you get a t-shirt. You bring your child to the game and you can walk out on the field. But you have to have your child with you. It's not that your child, you bring your child, you get a discounted ticket.
Yeah.
Because they're free or something. You now, the parent, it's an incentive. They have to bring their child.
Right.
I don't know exactly how to work that, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's, I mean, if you go to games now, there's a giveaway just about every home game you go to these days. Somebody is sponsoring some giveaway. But to your point, Leonard, is that you really want to get the kids there during the day, during the week in the summertime, have them come, let them come experience the game, let them come in and see batting practice, let them go down after the game and walk out onto the field. To me, I remember that as a kid walking into Yankee Stadium for the first time. It was like a cavern to me. It was so huge. And you used to be able to walk down. You used to be able to go down to the railing and ask for their autograph. You can't do that anymore. They just keep you away from doing that. And I think that's where, you know, they're missing out on that. It's that connectedness that a young kid had with a ball player, right?
Yes. Yes.
That is now lost because they just don't allow that to happen anymore. And that's a sad part of, I mean, we all grew up like that, right? But that's a sad thing that, you know, if they could bring that back, that, I mean, think about it, that would be nirvana to some 7 or 8 year old kid to see Aaron Judge up close like that, or Gleyber Torres or Aaron Hicks or Brandon Nimmo or any of the Met players, right? So Francisco Lindor, same thing.
Baseball has almost created a catch-22, because when you say to anyone, well, they need to start the games earlier or they need to do this, and they say, well, but the revenue is from the advertising and it needs to be in prime time and it needs to be later at night. It needs this. Okay. And the players, of course, want these huge salaries, and they're not going to get them if the teams aren't generating all this money. But if they're losing fans, they're not going to be able to keep this up. So it's a catch-22. What do you do? Are you going to work on getting more fans, but perhaps not generating as much revenue, and then the players aren't going to get the money or whatever, or lose fans and you're going to lose some of it, and you're going to lose revenue anyway? What do you do?
I want to come back to something you said earlier in the conversation, which was, you know, the decline. I can't remember exactly what you were saying, but you were talking about what is going to happen. You talked about boxing, right? And how boxing was, you know, a premier entertainment event, right? Years ago, right? And how that is not the case today. And could that happen for baseball? And that's one of the things that we are deathly afraid of, that baseball will become a tertiary sport here in the next 10 or 15 years. But let's go to what you just talked about advertising and all that. Think about it this way. If you don't have the Jeff or the Leonard 10-year-old today, or your sisters who are a year younger than you or older than you, and you don't become fans of baseball, what are you going to be doing when you become an adult of age and have an income and you can go attend games? What are you going to do with your entertainment dollars? Where are you going to go spend those entertainment dollars? Are you going to go spend them on football, basketball, baseball, hockey? Where are you going to spend your dollar? Now think about that. Now think about where the advertising money is going to be. Are they going to pay up for that person that is watching football, basketball, and hockey? Where's the baseball fan? If so, it has this compounding effect. Right. If we don't reverse some of these trends in 10 or 15 years, the advertising money is going to be moved to other sports. It's going to then start to impact the entire ecosystem of baseball. it's kind of like the old Fabergé commercial and so on and so on and so on. It mm-hmm. just has this multiplying effect, right? Yeah. It's all interconnected, right? All of these issues that we were trying to address with Save the Game, they're very basic, but they're all interconnected. And
that's a lot of
what we're talking about tonight.
Very important. Pat, can I would just like to recommend somebody for your board. All right. You have Billy Blitzer on your board, on your advisory board. You have Peter King. But Baseball and Barbecue is dedicated to two of our favorite subjects. And I cannot tell you how in love with this game Jeff Cohen is. And I'm just going to say right now, and I love him like a brother, okay? And I can't think of anyone who's better for the board than Jeff Cohen. I'm just saying.
All right.
I would like to nominate him for your board. That's all. I don't know how you get on your board, but...
We will certainly take that under advisement, Leonard. Obviously, Jeff is the baseball guy and you're the barbecue guy.
Well, that's how we always get pegged. And that's not true. Jeff is definitely as a baseball savant. Yeah. I love both. Okay. I can't tell you, you know, what uniform number so-and-so wore and all that, but I love the game. But Jeff is definitely, yes, Jeff is more. That's why I recommend him for the board.
So I will definitely talk about it with Kevin and some of the other.
I mean, he may.
Absolutely. We appreciate it. Look, I mean, you know, we want people that have, you know, the ability to get the message out there. You gentlemen certainly have the ability to get the message on. So, you know, I think you guys have some great ideas. You had some very thoughtful questions. But so you talk about uniform numbers, right? So, Jeff, who was your favorite team growing up as a kid?
Mets.
Mets. Okay. All right. We're going to go back to like the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
I'm going to give you're going to get all these. Cleon Jones.
21.
Tommy Agee.
20.
Kuzman.
36.
Nolan Ryan.
30.
Very good.
Yeah. that's Jeff.
Right. Swoboda.
He was 4.
Right. Yeah. Crane Pool.
He was 7.
And a guest on our show.
Yes. Yeah. And Tom Seaver, obviously.
The great Tom Seaver. Yes. I tell you what, Pat, you know, and I know we're running out of time here, and thank you for your time. The other thing to get kids involved in a game, and when Lennon was saying, bring your kid to a game, show them how to keep score. There's an art to that, you know?
I don't even think parents know how to keep score, actually, though, Jeff.
I mean, you can find them online now, but there's nothing like sitting down, keeping score, have your own type of shorthand, teaching it to your kid. I mean, you know, that brings it brings togetherness to the father-son, father-daughter relationship.
You guys know who Doris Kearns Goodwin is, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember watching the Ken Burns documentary Baseball, and she talked about her father and how she used to listen to the games, and you know, she would keep the box score and then tell her dad would be at work and then tell her dad what happened in the game, right? So that's how she became such a baseball fan at like 6-7 years old, right, when the Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. So yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be great that, you know, if, again, go back to, you know, Sunday Night Baseball, if David Cohn is sitting there with the broadcast and says, hey, our kids, this is how you keep this score. And this is how you write that down, you know, that type of teaching, just to tell, hey, kids, talk to the kid. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying they have to do that, but make it appealing to the kid. You make it appealing to the kid. You get them interested and they saying, hey, he's talking to me. Mm-hmm. Right. So anyway.
The teams need to send the players more to the schools. Maybe I don't know what they do there.
Oh, God,
but if a player comes to the school, this whole time, I feel like I'm just trying to think of ways. And by the way, Pat, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, you know, with Jeff. Okay. Jeff's probably like, I don't want more responsibility. I just put it out there, but I think what you guys are doing is incredible. I'm not ending this. I just want you to know that I think Baseball is a great game. Obviously, we love it. I mean, we have a, you know, baseball and barbecue. Obviously, we love the game.
We want to align with Major League Baseball. We're not here to pick a fight with them. We believe that some of the ideas that we have, we are working on some ideas to share with Major League Baseball at the right time. But certainly, you know, we do believe that they are trying, and we want to help, right? So, and help is a good four-letter word, you know.
Yes. Play.
So I think, again, we want to align with them. I think there's more. This is a 1+1=3 conversation. Some of their ideas, some of our ideas, you know, if you combine those two ideas, you could get a, you know, it could equal 3, right? So we're looking to get a force multiplier here so that we can, you know, have a much more broad impact on the game of baseball.
Is MLB aware of your campaign here?
I believe they are.
Okay, yes. Good. Good. Yeah. The website is savethegameus.com. Go there, read about it, sign the petition.
Yeah. Great, Jeff. That was going to be my closing pitch. Yeah. If you could ask your, you know, listeners to go to savethegameus.com. There's a link in there to sign the petition. We would be very grateful for your support. And I will definitely, Leonard, take Jeff's name and I will propose it to Kevin and the rest of the members to talk about Jeff joining the board.
And I mean,
you may have to do a background check.
But only if you send me some barbecue, Leonard.
You,
I mean,
you may have to do a background check on Jeff. Yeah. That might, I don't know what, you know, what that might bring up. But
Pat, I also want you to know, as we were talking tonight, I also tweeted that on our Twitter account. So hopefully that'll get some traction as well.
Well, thank you, Jeff. That's much appreciated.
Thank you very much, Pat. Again, savethegameus.com.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time tonight. Have a great evening.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
And we want to thank Pat Gagan for joining us. The organization is Save the Game. And Len, if I get on the board, I need you to be my agent.
Absolutely. At Jeff, I will be your agent. Yes, because I nominated you. But you haven't heard back from them, have you?
Not yet. I guess they're waiting for the podcast to come out. By the way, that website is savethegameus.com.
Right. Well, got to sign the petition, save the game. And also, I think they're doing a whole background check on you. So I think you're clean, but you never know the skeletons in that closet. So
everybody has skeletons.
Absolutely. So anyway, we have had a very busy week. We were actually interviewed for a podcast.
Yes, we were. Wow.
It was kind of the tables turned. We were actually on the Barbecue Happy Hour podcast with Messy Mike and Big Dan. You can't go on it if you don't have a nickname.
Right. You're Hollywood and I'm the OC.
Exactly. They were great. We had a great time with them. Thinking it'll be released sometime soon, but those guys are very busy. Big Dan runs his restaurant. Messy Mike runs his food truck. And so who knows? But we had a lot of fun with them, even if it never airs, which they may be having second thoughts. It still was a lot of fun getting to know those guys. And of course, Messy Mike was a guest on our show episode. I think, why do I want to say 126?
Yes, 126.
Yeah, they were a lot of fun.
And I want everybody remind everybody to give us a call at 516-855-8214. Comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. Tweet us. Use the Twitterverse.
Tweet.
Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. If you want to email us, our email is baseballandbbq@gmail.com. And our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please, please, please rate,
review, and subscribe.
Yes.
Rate, review, and subscribe. And Jeff, we'll just quickly remind everyone to go to baseballbbq.com for some incredible grilling tools and accessories. If you listen to this show, maybe this is your first time listening, but They have incredible grilling tools and accessories with baseball bat handles. And then, of course, Ray Sheehan, barbecuebuddha.com. Wow, the sauces, the rubs, the cookbooks. You cannot go wrong if you're looking for gifts for yourself, if you're looking for gifts for someone else. You know, you want to make your life easier with your rubs and sauces for grilling. Ray's stuff is top of the line, top notch. And of course, baseballbbq.com, top notch. So both of them great. Jeff, let's get right to part two, because I can't wait any longer, with Janice Smella and Doug Scheiding.
Janice, I saw something while doing research, because you mentioned a borrowed cooker, and I saw something about a burnt brisket. Could you enlighten us with your burnt brisket story, which turns out quite well?
Oh, yeah. Same contest. I went to Niagara Falls. So I went on a lark. I wanted to prove. So I've been cooking with my husband for a number of years, probably 5 or 6 years. And I got I felt that I could competently cook a contest by myself. But anything that is in driving distance, we cook together. And so I thought, you know what? There's a contest in Niagara Falls. They're looking for teams. I'm gonna prove to myself that I can do it. I'm gonna borrow some equipment, and my whole goal there was to cook independently, get the four meats in. I'd never cooked on the drums before, for a contest at least. And I was looking up YouTube videos of, I had a Gateway drum smoker already, but I was looking up YouTube videos of Tim Shear and his trimming methodology and how to cook a brisket on a drum. And what I didn't realize was, like, because your charcoal is straight underneath your brisket, you really need to turn your brisket or flip it over just to, you don't get any hot spots on your brisket, because you're cooking hot and fast. So even though the dial says 300 degrees, I think you're cooking more at 350 degrees. And so, you know, I did what I saw on YouTube, and my brisket literally was burnt on the bottom. And so I had a little bit of a fat layer on the bottom, but I didn't know that it was burnt until I took it out of the packaging when I went to box it. And it was so burnt that it was hard. So I cut off the bottom, and my whole cutting board had all these like black flakes all over the cutting board. And Doug would know, like, appearance is one of the scores that you're going to get from the judges. And so I was horrified. I had black flakes all over the cutting board, and I was wiping the cutting board as at the same time I'm making my slices of the flat and picking little pieces off. And the guy that I borrowed equipment from, he had already turned in. And so he's like watching me and laughing. And I gave him a slice of brisket, and I'm still wiping the cutting board and picking off these little flakes. And he's like, "It's really good." And I was like, "That's nice." I was like, I was not impressed. So I finished boxing, and I sent in my brisket box, and that's the last turn in for the meats. And my accomplishment was done. I was super happy. I put in all four meats. I did a contest by myself. And it was like, there was a heat wave there, and Calgary doesn't get any humidity. So I don't know what humidity is, but it was really hot. And it was like 70 or 80% humidity. So it was not a comfortable moment. And so when they did awards, I was sitting in the shade way in the back, not really paying attention because I was done. So they called the awards, and I got a call for chicken, and I got a call for ribs, and I got a call for pork. And I thought, oh, this is pretty good. And then I stopped listening because I burnt my brisket. That's what I was thinking. And sure enough, I win brisket, and I win the contest overall. But I really wasn't paying attention. So I wasn't like, usually in your head, you kind of have a count of like where people are and where you're going to land. But because I wasn't expecting to win brisket for sure or the contest. It was quite comical. And then the follow-up to that story is that the trophies were enormous. They were like big, giant bowling trophies. And I'm not your typical, I probably don't have the typical stature of someone in barbecue or who you expect. I'm Asian. I'm 5 feet tall, no inches. The trophy came up to my chin. So it was a fun day.
Well, I know I've seen you at Bozeman, Montana at the Pitmaster a couple of times. And, you know, I think last time we saw each other, you had your own equipment in the U.S. waiting across the border. And so I know you don't always borrow equipment. How many places do you have extra equipment that, you know, where you fly to and you have, you know, equipment there waiting on, your equipment waiting on you?
Oh, well, now I have to confess the crazy part of me, right? That's what you're
okay,
going
yeah,
for,
yes, exactly.
This show is all about confession. Yes, we confess on this show. At least I do.
All right. So, as I said, I usually cook with my husband. We have like a vintage Airstream trailer that we cook out of. And we've converted to cooking on Gateway drum smokers. Love them. They're great. It's something I can move because I told you I'm not big and tall. And what we used to cook on was a Pitmaker Vault, which was 1,000 pounds and pretty hard to arm wrestle out of a truck. So, after cooking in Niagara Falls, I started to get excited. I was like, hey, I can do this more often. And my husband was just like, oh my gosh, she's crazy. I don't want to be all over the country cooking in these weird locations. And I had cooked in Seattle a couple years ago, and it was fun, and I borrowed equipment. But the cold wind and the rain was not great to be cooking outside. And so I said, you know, if I was going to cook by myself, it's really hard to know what the weather conditions of the contest. I really want to be able to control that. And if everybody else is cooking out of a trailer, I want to cook out of something that has walls as well. So on a drive back, he said, well, what if you got a van? And so the next thing I know, we bought an old plumbing van. It's like a high top, you know, it's a high top Nissan 2500, but it's like a Ford Dash or whatnot. And we gutted the inside, moved some things around, and I can keep the smokers in there. And I also have a table in there and just the basic necessities of what I need. And so the plan was to park it in various spots along the Pacific Northwest, and I would fly in and out of the various cities and basically line up the van to be at the next contest or close to the next contest. So basically what we did was we drove it out to Seattle, and then I drove it to Portland for the next contest, which was in Redmond, not too far from Portland. And I flew home, and then I would fly back, you know, do a contest and move it to the next city, which I think was going to actually be back in Canada, in Chilliwack, BC. But COVID happened. And so after the contest in Seattle, the van got stranded in Portland. The contest got canceled like 2 days before it was supposed to run. And at the time, like, there wasn't any limitations in Canada, but you weren't traveling to the U.S. for fun. So we left it there, and it ended up sitting in Portland for 18 months before I could rescue it.
Wow.
And so the border was not open to drive. I could not drive into the U.S., but I could fly. So there was like some funny loophole. So I could fly into Portland, and then because I'm a Canadian citizen, they actually had to let me back in. That became the plan. So as soon as I realized I had the opportunity to go get the van, I lined it up with the barbecue contest, of course, And we, my daughter and I, we flew into Portland, drove it to Montana, saw Doug, did a contest, had a great time, and then drove home and crossed the border and brought it back home. So I don't have that many places where I'm hiding equipment.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe like Darren Worth and had, you know, Jambos stored throughout the U.S. So
I'll have to win a few more contests, I think, first.
18 months and it was untouched. I mean, it was still wasn't everything was as you left it.
Yeah, it was great. I was really worried that it would be really moldy inside just because it's so much more humid in Portland, but it was great. Turns out that Russell, my husband, had a distant cousin who lives in Portland, so he moved it to his property instead of sitting at the airport parking. But it was fantastic.
It was airport parking would have cost a bit of a bundle. My God, can you just turn it into them?
Yeah.
It's yours.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what it would have cost? Yeah, you're right. 18 months, airport parking. I mean, I don't know about Portland, but here in New York area airports? Oh, forget. Whoa.
Exactly.
Yeah. That'd be worth more than the van itself.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Janice. You, another thing that you have on your website is barbecue. You have this, it says barbecue and cooking make my weekends. If I'm not cooking, then it must not be the weekend.
That's
true. Could you elaborate on that?
I think that I said I like to cook. And so I definitely made time for it when, especially during COVID. And so, but we have days like barbecue does not pay for my life. I have a day job, unfortunately or fortunately. And actually maybe it's more fortunate because it pays for my expensive hobby. We have days where on the weekdays, especially we have fend for yourself days. So my kids are very used to not having meals cooked by mom because it is a weekend or it's not a weekend. So in many cases on the weekends, we're prepping for a contest or we're unpacking from a contest. And so, you know, I'll look up and it'll be 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I haven't fed the kids anything yet. And so they know to fend for themselves, but that's starting to happen over the weekdays as well. So I try to make sure that on the weekends, those are cooking days. Those are days that I can definitely devote to barbecue and other cooking adventures.
How old are your kids?
They are 11 and 13.
So let me ask you this. When you're not in a competition and you're in your home barbecuing, do you cook anything unique? And also, do you have like a specialty that you like to cook?
I think things have changed, I would say, after COVID. After doing Supper Challenge for 2 years, I've really tried to make sure anything I cook challenges me or is interesting. I live by a Korean grocery store in my neighborhood, and my favorite thing to do is like to wander into the store and pick up a package and think, what is this? And take it home and make something of it. So I'll go to the internet to be inspired, or I'll go to the internet to like see what, you know, what something traditional is. But generally I'll try to make something up. The funny part is I feel like I'm a home cook for sure. I like to try recipes, or I like to think I like to try recipes, but I'm terrible at following recipes. So I kind of just go with the version of like, I'll try something, but I'll adjust the recipe in my head as I go along. And then most times it works out. Sometimes I have some disasters. So nothing specific, but it's always an adventure in my house. But my poor daughter is like not always impressed, because like the days that I come home, I came home with a pig snout and pig tongue, and I think it was a lamb heart. She was not so happy that day.
Most kids just want to eat chicken nuggets.
Yeah.
And French fries. Oh my God. Mom, what's for dinner? Oh, we're going to have a lamb's heart. Oh, goody.
With a side
what
of snout.
What I always wanted.
Right. They're inviting their friends over. Come over to my house for dinner. We're having pig snout.
Yeah. That's true.
Oh, man.
Well, does that go along with kind of the bush cooking? I know you develop recipes and things like that for bush cooking. Can you tell me kind of what that is about?
Yeah. So Saffron is a friend of mine. She's a fantastic cook.
I know Saffron.
Yeah. So she asked me a couple of years ago if I would share some recipes with her on her website. And we both have this love for outdoor cooking. So I really push myself, like, I think there's definitely a place for chicken and ribs and steak and burgers on Wednesdays. But I think that, I don't know, like, I obviously like the adventure of what cooking could be or should be. And so from that part, I pushed myself a little bit. At that point, I wasn't really cooking, you know, pig snout and that kind of thing yet, but it gave me an opportunity to really start thinking outside of my comfort level. And so and it was great, because I do think I have, even though I'm a home cook, I'm quite studious, and or I think you and I, Doug, are quite scientific about the way we cook. We want to know why something happens and what happens, you know, if you inject tallow or if you smear it all around the top. Or, right. You know, what happens to meat when you do things to it. So I love the science aspect. And so I think that makes some of the recipes I have more thoughtful. I'm not, you know, they're tested by me. I'm not sure how qualified that is. But I would also say that I'm, like, pretty stringent on, like, when I look at a recipe, I feel like I question the science behind it, because sometimes you can look at a recipe, anyone can post a recipe online, but you know, if you get ribs that are cooked 1 hour, I don't know, they might be a little bit tight. They're probably not going to be my liking.
That's for sure. Yes.
Well, yeah.
You know, you talk about the science of cooking, so it made me think of beer can chicken, because I, you know, there's different views on whether beer can chicken actually, the beer really does something, okay? So we have two scientific cooks. And Doug, I thought you were a baseball expert. I didn't even know you cooked, but I guess you do dabble. So Janice and Doug, and we'll start with Janice, what are your thoughts on beer can chicken?
Beer can chicken is great. It gives everybody an excuse to have a beer. That's really what everyone wants.
Okay.
Does the beer do anything to the chicken? I would say not really. But there's definitely, like, the essence of beer that would be cooked onto the surface of the chicken. But once you slather some sauce on it, I question it. But everyone gets excited when you say, I made beer cat chicken. So for that purpose alone, I think, like, it has its place in the backyard market.
Exactly.
Doug?
Yeah, I would say I'm not a huge beer can chicken fan, because I think it's a waste of a good beer that you could have had. But if you got the throne, like with the little motorcycle, you know, and you put the chicken on the little motorcycle on the throne, that has the airflow that it can flow up in the inside, I think you're good for a good presentation.
Gotcha.
But you know what, Doug? I don't know if you know this, but Canadian beer and American beer, they have different alcohol contents.
Yes, exactly, yes.
So American beer probably doesn't have as the same flavor content, we'll say, as what a Canadian beer would have.
No, that's probably true. That's probably true.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'm assuming Canadian beer is a lot stronger.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured that. Yes. And
so, John, you've been to the American Royal World Series of Barbecue, the Jack Daniels, Houston Livestock. Tell us your experiences there at the World Series of Barbecue and the Jack Daniels.
It's phenomenal. I'm not. It's phenomenal, but I'm not going to either one this year. You know what? It's really neat to have a meeting of the barbecue minds, to go to, especially, like I said, the Canadian barbecue circuit and community is quite small. It's great because it's tight. Everyone knows each other. It's very welcoming. We can't wait to meet new people on the circuit. But I would also say you go down to the U.S. and to cook at the American Royal, where there's like upwards of 400 to 600 teams, is like jaw-dropping. Just to think that there's that many teams in one spot cooking, it's definitely an experience. The one thing that I did learn, I've cooked the Royal a couple times, and it's so hot. Like the temperatures of cooking in the U.S., that's when I realized, like, I'm a winter cook. I know what to do when it's really cold. We run our Cambros differently, like our insulated coolers a little bit differently in Canada than we would in the U.S. When I was watching a whole bunch of YouTube videos when we're getting into the competition circuit, people said you had to vent your Cambros so that any excess heat could escape. Well, if you do that in Canada, you're basically gonna, your meat could seize because it's so cold sometimes. If you get a gust of wind, the tenderness that you have in your meat will go away because it will basically get the muscle fibers of the meat to tighten up. So, anyways, it's a neat congregation of all sorts of people, of all walks of people that just love barbecue. And so there's a lot of fangirling, I would say, because I saw Tuffy Stone and he was walking, you know, along the way. Should I bug him for a picture? But it's also a great experience because, like, I would say that barbecue people in general are super personable. That's how I met Doug. He happened to be cooking in Bozeman, Montana, and that happened to be the year that we got invited to the Houston Rodeo. For the first time, yeah. It was phenomenal, and we've kept in touch since. So
I know, it's been great. It's been great. So, yeah, the Houston Rodeo, you didn't say about the Houston Rodeo. And are you coming this following year? Are you coming next year to the Houston Rodeo?
I think I am. Yeah.
Awesome.
We'll have a chat with Brian, but I think we were going to be invited again, and I'm coming to San Antonio Rodeo too.
Oh, you are? Are you going to do the same and spend this whole month down here?
Well, I don't know if that will fly anymore. In COVID, when we're working from home, have to fly home this time in between.
Okay. Doug, you got some competition, Doug.
Oh, yeah. No, Janice kicked butt at both of them, at the San Antonio and the Houston. So, she did great this year. So, and I know my wife loves to have dessert discussions with you. So when you were saying, I thought your favorite thing to cook was going to be dessert, because you always seem to be working on a new dessert recipe. Like when you came to my house and you brought, if I can say, is it the key lime cheesecake or something wild that you were working on?
Yeah.
Or the Houston Rodeo, I think.
Yep. So I think I like cooking dessert the most.
Okay.
But my hips don't like it as much as my brain does, or as much as my belly does. So I have to, you know, fill it with something different. Otherwise, I'll just eat dessert all the time.
Okay, okay. All right. Well, one of your specialties, the peanut roll with caramelized bananas?
That's another recipe on my website. It was okay. You know what actually does super well is the banana bread French toast with the peanut cream and bacon bits.
Oh,
that one.
I think I just gained 5 pounds.
Right? See?
Oh, wow.
That's actually, you know, the funny part, my daughter's 13th birthday was a couple weeks ago, and that was the favorite amongst all of her friends. They slept over, and that was requested breakfast by all of the girls. And I thought it was funny because, you know, you mentioned what the kids don't really want to invite their friends over for goat heart, but banana bread, okay.
Janice, you know, it's funny because you mentioned Tuffy Stone and you know, these pitmasters, but my first recollection of watching barbecue on TV is actually a Canadian chef, and that's Rob Rainford, and he had a show called License to Grill. Rob Rainford, and I'll never forget, he had, that was the first time I saw he was using two grills, and I was very young at the time, and I thought, wow, that's so cool. He was using two grills, and that was such a big concept. I'm like, wow, you don't have to fit everything on one. But he was incredible, and I'm guessing that maybe you haven't heard of him because you have not.
I have not. I apologize.
Google
I will.
Him. Rob Rainford, License to Grill. And I don't know, you know, what happened to him, but it was a good show. It was a good cooking show.
That's great.
Yeah.
And there's so many great cooks out there. That's the best part, is like the sharing aspect,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was Canadian. I mean, and that was, so, you know, you guys have, you know, we have Tuffy Stone, but you have Rob Rainford and of course, Janice Smella. So.
Is Doug a good sharer?
Doug is excellent in sharing.
Thank you. In fact, I'm so good. She has a chicken video that she's been holding hostage that I want from her of that first time in Bozeman.
That video is so good that the size is so large that there is no platform that will download it off my phone. I've been trying for the past, I don't know, 4 years.
Oh,
five
gosh.
Years.
Okay.
I think the phone is aging out, truthfully.
No problem. So yeah, let's end on the beginning. How did you kind of get into cooking, and was it you or Russell, or it sounds like it was you that actually started getting into the barbecue cooking?
It was Russell.
It was okay.
Russell. So we've always deemed ourselves foodies. So when my daughter was first born, maternity leave in Canada is awesome. It's a year. 1 year paid leave.
One year pays.
Wow.
It's not like any, you're not going to get rich on what you're paid, but you should be able to pay, you know, your grocery bill. But it is a paid leave. And so we drove down to California. And then from California, during maternity leave, we made our way to Texas. And I found Texas Monthly, the magazine that. And this was the first year they raided all of the barbecue joints in Texas. I thought, this is amazing. And I don't know that I had real barbecue before. So I made it my mission. I was going to try all of the top five. And then, unfortunately, we both got a stomach bug. And after Texas, we already had a plan to move or to drive to New Orleans. And then we were going to make it home after that. So it was like the barbecue trip that never happened. So a couple of years later, I had my son, and my parents said, we want to give you some time alone. You're young parents. You should do something fun. You should have some time to yourself. So Russell and I flew to Houston, and we made that barbecue trek around Central Texas, and we ate ourselves silly. We ate at all five of the places that were listed from however many years ago, and we ate ourselves silly, and then realized that we could not have barbecue again, like not in the city of Calgary. There was no barbecue joints in Calgary, definitely not serving that caliber of food. And so on our way out, we happened to go to various pit makers, including Pit Maker in Houston. And we ended up buying the vault that I mentioned that's 1,000 pounds and the size of a large refrigerator. And that's sort of like we got inspired, we wanted to eat. And when we ordered it, and I looked at Russell, I'm like, how are we gonna run this thing? Like, what do we know about cooking barbecue? It was great. It was a bit of a spontaneous purchase, I guess. But like, we ate all this great barbecue, and then we bought this pit that like nobody else in Canada has. Nobody knows how to run. What are we gonna do with this big steel box? And at that time, Barbecue Pit Masters was one of the TV shows that was on, and YouTube was a thing. And so everybody at that time that was running a pit maker vault was on the competition circuit. So Russell said, we should enter a contest because Calgary has a barbecue contest that happens every year at Labor Day. And I don't know if you can make the association between not knowing how to cook on a pit whatsoever to let's enter a contest where we have to cook four meats and we've never seen a full pack of brisket before, let alone cooked one. That's not usually like the normal course of action, but trial by fire, we figured it out. So, and we got hooked. We did really well in our first competition. It was in Edmonton at the first Porkapalooza contest.
Oh, Porkapalooza, yeah.
Yeah. You'll laugh. We didn't know how to run the pit. We ran. The pit was so hot that we cooked with the door open. And our brisket was so overcooked that we sent in a box with pulled brisket.
Wow.
Pulled brisket strands.
Probably a little dry.
Probably. I'll have to show you a picture. I kept it. I have a picture of it.
Okay,
it does not look like brisket.
Okay.
But it was entertaining. But the funny part is that I think we got a call in the top five for the brisket. So we figured something out. So it was really like Russell's interest to begin with. And then, I don't know, I guess I'm more hungry than he is. And I always want to perfect things. The scientific part of me wanted to make things better. So I got my elbows in there and I started messing around.
I had a feeling that was how it was. That's awesome. From those humble beginnings to three-time national Canadian barbecue team of the year, Janice Smeller, anything you want to promote, anything you want to talk about before we let you go this evening?
I just want people to share in barbecue. There is so much, you know, like the competition circuit's one thing, but, you know, COVID's over. We can share in food. We can share recipes. And, you know, I would say like the barbecue community is super amazing in terms of being, you know, we love barbecue and we love sharing food. So if you are interested in some weird and wacky recipes, you can go to my website at smellaq.com. But or if you want to share your experiences, maybe that's even better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight, Janice. This has been a very fun hour. Learned a lot of amazing things, and, yeah, you know, we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to us.
Thank you so much, Janice. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, and thanks for saying yes before we knew you were a fire master and TV star. That is awesome.
TV celebrity, TV star, fire master. That's right.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast, and if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out, Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you very much, Janice. Thank you, Doug. And you know what, Jeff? I'm actually glad you split it into two parts because it gave me something to look forward to. Is there a third part?
No, not yet.
We should remind everyone that the show is brought to you by Bet Online, where the game starts. But this game is not starting. This game is ending.
Yeah.
So as we end, we thank our guests. We thank Pat Gagan from Save the Game. We ask everyone to go sign the petition. And also, you know, if you sign the petition, we get enough signatures. Who knows? Maybe Jeff does get on the board.
There you go.
Right, Jeff? Right. You're going to save the game? You're going to help save the game?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then thank you to Janice Smella, Doug Scheiding. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Len.
Thank you to the poet, Shel Kukofsky, the musician, Dave Dresser, for this beautiful song that we love to conclude with. It is Baseball Always Brings You Home. Goodbye, everyone. See you on episode 147.